Welcome to Hearing the Pulitzers, a piece-by-piece, episode-by-episode exploration of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize in Music, with hosts Andrew Grenade and David Thurmeyer.
Welcome to Hearing the Pulitzers, where today we have a special bonus episode featuring an interview with Dr. Howard Pollack, John and Rebecca Moore's Professor of Musicology at the University of Houston. Dr. Pollack's work will be known to many of our listeners since he has written about many notable American composers like Aaron Copland, George Gershwin, Walter Piston, John Alden Carpenter, Mark Blitzstein, and most recently, Samuel Barber. Dr. Pollack has been at the University of Missouri, Kansas City for the past couple of days, and we're interviewing him in front of a live audience at our Musicology Music Theory Forum. So welcome to Dr. Pollack. Hello, Howard.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. We're glad to have you. Start out by telling us a little bit about your early upbringing, your musical training, and how you became a musicologist.
I went to the University of Michigan as a piano major and wound up graduating with a degree in music history because I found myself really intrigued by that field. And then after a year off, I went to Cornell University for my master's and PhD, and I was very fortunate to study with William Austin, whose book, Music of the 20th Century, from Debussy to Stravinsky, I recommend to any musician interested in 20th century concert music, and jazz, too. It was very advanced for its time for spotlighting various jazz artists as well, because the book came out in, I think, 1965 or 1966. And I subsequently lived a few years in Rochester. I was continuing my research while living up there, and I studied composition with Samuel Adler while I was in Rochester, but not at the Eastman School. And then I attained a position at the University of Houston, and that was in 1987, and I've been there ever since.
So when you were looking for a subject, why did you end up focusing on American composers? And do you think you're talking about it was early when people were studying American composers. So was there a stigma you felt like you had to work against in getting your work off and going?
Well, I didn't think in those terms because I really wasn't thinking of a career in graduate school. I was thinking just of studying. You know, things have changed, I think. People are more conscious of careers now when they go to school. But at that time, or it may have been just my naivete, but I was part of the reason for my interest in American music was because William Austin was very interested in American music. As a matter of fact, when I saw that his two specialties were American music and Russian music, that was one of the things that intrigued me about going to Cornell and studying with him, because those were two areas of music that I was interested in. And I wrote in my comprehensive exam, I was asked by William Austin to write a history of the French and American symphony in the 20th century. That was one of my comprehensive questions. And in response to my answer, he said, it looks like you really admire the symphonies of Walter Piston. And I said, yes, I do. And he had studied, actually, with Walter Piston at Harvard. He was at Harvard about the same time as Leonard Bernstein. And it was one of Austin's great claims to fame that he was chosen over Leonard Bernstein to accompany the Glee Club at Harvard. He was a brilliant pianist and harpsichordist, kind of the total musician. And he said, well, maybe you might want to consider writing about Walter Piston then. Walter Piston was still alive at the time. And I think that he wrote a letter on my behalf, which I think you saw at the David saw at the Library of Congress, in which he and I think Walter Piston got that letter and saw that a musicologist was about to write about him and subsequently died. I think a few weeks later. So I never, unfortunately, had a chance to meet or interview Walter Piston. But that got me sort of on the path toward researching American music.
So you mentioned how you got into Piston, and that was your dissertation topic and your first book. We have a collection of your books on the piano there. How do you choose your research subjects? Because you have the famous American composers like Copland, Gershwin, but you've also done John Latouche, as you've mentioned, who was kind of a not as famous person, and John Alden Carpenter, people like that. So how do you choose? What's your research subject choice process?
Well, the most important criterion for me is to love the music, because it usually takes me about 5 years, 5 to 6 years to actually research and write and publish one of these big books. And so I have to feel that I'm going to be living with the music for a long time. And so I don't really give that much consideration to what has been written about him already, though that's definitely one consideration, and also the amount of material that's out there, access to material, all of that. But primarily my interest in the person and the interest in the music. The John Latouche book is, I think, has an interesting backstory to it, because there were several composers I was interested in, namely, at this point, this was later in my career. This was the book, I don't know the year it came out, but it was about 8 or 9 years ago. And I was thinking about various composers I was interested in, and among them were Duke Ellington and Vernon Duke, who was originally known as Vladimir Dukhelsky. And he had sort of that Gershwin-esque career where he worked on Broadway and as a classical composer. And Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Maross, a little-known composer who I liked. And it occurred to me that they had all worked with the same lyricist, librettist, which was John Latouche. And I thought, this might be interesting to, instead of tracing a composer's career, trace a librettist, lyricist's career, who apparently was so good that all these very esteemed composers would seek him out and work with him. And he died young, too. So in his short life, he worked with Duke Ellington, Leonard Bernstein, Vernon Duke, Jerome Maross, Douglas Moore. And that was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing that, focusing on a wordsmith. I wasn't sure with my background. At that point, I had written about, especially Mark Blitzstein, who wrote his own words. I felt enough confidence that I thought I could write about a wordsmith, though a lot of the book pays attention to the music of the theatrical works that he collaborated on as well.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit then, because you said 5 years to research, write, publish one of these books. If you talk, because we have a room full of a lot of students and researchers, what's your process? So you decide, I'm going to write on Aaron Copland, I'm going to write on John Latouche. What then is your process then in starting the research and getting the research done and then writing?
Well, I try to assemble all the material that I can possibly have. So I've spent a lot of time in archives, looking at letters, sketches, manuscript. I do a lot of reception history too. My biographies go beyond the death date of the composer or the figure, and I look at contemporary uses of the music, films that use the music I don't know how, when I wrote my Barber book, I don't know how many films I watched that used the adagio for strings, but it had to run into the dozens. And not only American films, but films all over the world that have used adagio for strings. It turns out to be like some of the most used film music of all time, though Samuel Barber himself never wrote for movies. he didn't have any interest in that. So there's a lot of material to collect. And I spend a few years just doing research before I even begin writing. And then there's the writing process. And as I'm doing the writing, there's additional research that I need to be doing as well. But I try to get a basic hold of all the material that that I need.
And along those same lines, what do you like most and least about the research process?
Well, I would say I do enjoy really all aspects of the research process. I imagine what's most frustrating is knowing that there's some material out there that I can't get my hands on for one reason or another. That could be, there's a lot of banging one's head against the wall. And you need to have a lot of perseverance if you're going to, I think, be a biographer, because there's a lot of things that are not forthcoming. Fortunately, I have to say that I've been very, very, I mean, I've read all sorts of horror stories about biographers who are trying to get material and the family holds on to them and doesn't let go of things and so forth. I've been very lucky. I've had a lot of cooperation from family members. A lot of my subjects did not have children. All my subjects were deceased by the time that, of course, I wrote about them. Usually there were nephews, nieces, maybe grandchildren, who were all very, very helpful and supportive. That makes a big difference. I didn't necessarily know that would be the case once beginning my research, but I did find out, you know, down the line that there were many people that were helpful and supportive.
So, I mean, we have a huge line of books over there. I know books are like children, right? They're all your favorite. Mm-hmm. But if you had to point to ones that you thought really succeeded in your goals, what would you kind of point out and why?
Well, it's really, that's really almost an impossible question to answer. I think that I was really pleased with the Copeland book from the perspective of, I think it was the first book or the first real public statement about Copeland in which I dealt with his homosexuality. And that was 1999. And I was really pleased that, believe it or not, it was still controversial back then to talk about a great American, you know, hero like Copeland in those terms. And I was really pleased that people were very respectful in their response and that it was not considered sensational or anything of that nature. So I think that was an important landmark in terms of scholarship, to be able to do that. I had probably most fun with the Latouche book because he was just such a great character. A wild, wild, wild character, and it got me to write. It was all theater history, and that's fun. I'm fond of all of them. It was great to get to know Mark Blitzstein in the kind of depth I did because he was a very political figure, and he really shed light on the relationship between music and politics in a way that my other subjects didn't necessarily do. Though a lot of, because I'm dealing with this period of the mid-century, the relationship, especially going through the Depression, World War II, the Cold War, all of that, the music and politics were very much intertwined during that period. So that actually is a theme that runs through a lot of my books.
Well, of course, this is the Hearing the Pulitzers podcast, so we have to talk about the Pulitzer Prize. So you've written about three Pulitzer Prize winners, Copeland, Barber, and Walter Piston. and have certainly included a fourth in your recent book on Samuel Barber, would be Giancarlo Menotti. What did prizes like the Pulitzer mean to these composers? And do you think the pieces that they won for were deserving of those awards?
Well, I just want to add two other figures to the composers you mentioned, because Latouche also worked with Douglas Moore. And
Two Giants on the Earth?
No, he did The Ballad of Baby Doe. He was the librettist for The Ballad of Baby Doe, which people would say is Douglas Moore's greatest work. It's interesting, Latouche really worked on... very often on the works regarded as these composers' greatest works. Like Cabin in the Sky, the musical he wrote with Vernon Duke, is the outstanding Vernon Duke musical. Candide by Bernstein, a lot of people have great regard for. And Jerome Morris's work. And Duke Ellington's Beggar's Holiday is considered his greatest musical. And I think there's going to be finally a recording of that, the commercial recording that's going to be coming out pretty soon of Duke Ellington's Beggar's Holiday, which is a take on the Beggar's Holiday that Kurt Weill adapted and Bertolt Brecht's Three Penny Opera. This is kind of an American version of it. It was for its time. It was quite notable in the late '60s for having an interracial cast and even having an interracial romance. It was Duke Ellington, a black composer, and John Latouche, a white lyricist, collaborating on that piece. I'm very, very happy that a recording will be forthcoming about it. And so there's Ellington as well. And I'm surprised, looking over this list of Pulitzer Prize winners, that actually Leonard Bernstein never won a Pulitzer Prize. That was surprising to me. The other person to mention, there were a couple of other connections, because I do have a book, Harvard Composers, Walter Piston and His Students. And looking over that, I see Elliot Carter, of course, is there. Gail Kubik, who won the 1952 Pulitzer Prize, was a student of Piston's. And Yehudi Weiner, who was also a Pulitzer Prize winner, was another student of Piston's, as was, well, Leonard Bernstein, but he was not a Pulitzer Prize winner. So there are other people that have popped up. And currently, I'm researching Ernest Bloch, who never did win a Pulitzer Prize, though he did win a gold medal from the Academy of Arts and Sciences, which would be interesting if we have a moment to talk about that award as well. And among his students, there were at least three Pulitzer Prize winners that I've identified, and that's Quincy Porter, Roger Sessions, and Leon Kirshner. So there's a lot of Pulitzer Prize winners kind of floating around in my scholarship.
Well, and this is one of the things that we've noticed in doing the podcast, is that the connections, it's like, oh, so-and-so knows so-and-so, so they get the Pulitzer next, and then they seem to pass it around. So I mean, that's kind of what we're curious about in your mind in doing this research. I mean, what really was the significance of the Pulitzer, and how was it thought about by the winners and by those who were awarding it to their friends?
Well, it was certainly, I mean, you'd have to take this on a case-by-case basis. Sure. It's very hard to generalize about it. Certainly, Aaron Copland winning the Pulitzer Prize for Appalachian Spring, I think was very important for his career, because he had started his career writing music, I think, in a more modernist vein. And he was not really that well-known composer for a long time in his career. It's easy to know what age Copland was when he wrote a certain piece, because he was born in 1900. So 1944, Appalachian Spring, he was 44 years old. So he was not exactly, you know, a very young composer. You know, works like the Piano Variations, of course, had developed a large following among the community of American composers, but it was not a work to reach the large public. Of course, things had changed. once he began writing these ballet scores and film scores in the late 1930s and 40s. And naturally, because he was writing for ballet and writing for film, he kind of adjusted his score accordingly and won a, you know, his films for Hollywood in the late 1930s and 40s. Virtually all of them were nominated for Academy Awards, finally won by The Heiress. And then he stopped writing films, film scores, you know, in the late 40s and the 50s. And the ballet scores, three of them, he had written one earlier, two earlier ballet scores, but three ballet scores written in quick succession in the late 30s and early 40s, Billy the Kid, Rodeo, and Appalachian Spring, were very successful. And so Copland very quickly became sort of a household name as a composer, due largely to these works. Of course, the Pulitzer Prize for Appalachian Spring owed a lot to Martha Graham, of course, too. It was a ballet, and it was very effective as a ballet. It remains maybe Martha Graham's greatest works, arguably. I mean, people really do think this is Martha Graham at her very best. So the combination of Graham and Copland in getting the Pulitzer Prize, I think, was very important for his career.
Well, we want to make sure we have enough time for our audience questions. So you mentioned what you're working on now. So you're working on a biography of Ernst Bloch.
Okay. There's also, to make things more confusing, there's a very famous philosopher known among philosophers, Ernst Bloch.
Oh, no.
So very often in writers confuse them, and, you know, you'll find in the index an Ernst Bloch meaning Ernest Bloch and an Ernest Bloch meaning Ernst Bloch. So be on the lookout for you're interested.
Look forward to you sorting that out in your biography. So tell us about that work, because he's a different, is he maybe the first foreign-born that you've talked about? He's born in Switzerland, right? French Swiss.
Yes, I think there may have been one of the Harvard composers that may have been, well, Samuel Adler, at least one I could think of. Samuel Adler is one of the 33 composers that are profiled in Harvard Composers. He was a Piston student. And there might be others. I just don't recall offhand. But yes, the only subject that I'm devoting a large book to, who is foreign-born. He was born in Geneva and came to the United States in 1916, sort of. He was around 35 years old, 36 years old at the time. So he spent half his career in Europe and half his career in the U.S. And it was actually one of the things he kind of complains about a lot in his, you know, I'm not accepted by the Swiss. I'm not accepted by the Americans. That's like a leitmotif that runs through all his letters. Though he was, I mentioned before, the gold medal, and he did win the 1942 gold medal from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is a very distinguished award. I think he was the, I have this list here, was he the fourth winner of that? And that would be, he would be followed by Igor Stravinsky and Aaron Copland. One of the things I noticed, by the way, since this is a Pulitzer podcast, looking over this list this morning, you know, other people that could have won the Pulitzer Prize. I don't know if you've discussed this on this podcast,
every episode, yeah.
But, you know, you think Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra? That seems like a no-brainer. And I was surprised that Stravinsky never won a Pulitzer Prize either. So those are two. And Hindemith never won a Pulitzer Prize. So there are these. And I don't think Luciano Berio ever won a Pulitzer Prize. So, and I don't think John Cage ever won a Pulitzer Prize. So there are these big names in American music that were not recipients of the award. But Bloch did, Bloch did win in the course of his lifetime, he did win he won a lot of awards in the course of his career. He was a little bit removed from the, you know, I'm sure all these awards, like you alluded to before, have to do with your friendships and who you know and where you are. And Bloch did live a lot of his life like a hermit, in a way. When he did move to the United States, he was quickly became the first director of the Cleveland Institute of Music, from 1920 to 1925. Their first director, and then things went south in Cleveland, and he took over the directorship of the San Francisco Conservatory from 1925 to 1930. But then after 1930, he basically lived a very isolated life, either in rural Switzerland or on the East Coast in Oregon. He did come to Berkeley to give a summer course every year for 5 weeks. So he did, you know, he had that connection. That's when those were his final students, Leon Kirshner, Earl Kim, who both studied with him at Berkeley. But basically, he was living in a very remote house on the Oregon coast. So probably that didn't help his career. But that was the way he chose to live his life.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that we've seen, is that if you're in New York, you have a higher probability of winning the Pulitzer than if you're in Chicago or San Francisco or, you know, somewhere else. Well, we wanted to open it up and if there are any questions from the audience that people might have. So
come up to the mic.
My question, I think you've worked on some really interesting figures as well as topics who kind of straddled the classical popular divide, or high, low, high, maybe high, medium is maybe a better description. And I think it's just a really interesting time in musicology where, on the one hand, there's just been a huge expansion of the topics that people study and a great valorization of many different topics. And at the same time, it's kind of a confusing time where, you know, what's the canon? What belongs in the canon? Can we do criticism and say some types of music are better than others? Are we just going to be totally relativistic about that? Does high-low even exist? All of those kinds of questions swirl about the AMS conferences and et cetera, et cetera. And then even with prizes, it's kind of interesting that prizes kind of struggle with this. You know, is Bob Dylan a Nobel-worthy candidate in literature? There's a lot of, things to talk about there. But all of that to say, I'm interested in how you approach some of these issues and kind of the high-low question in your work on these figures and on, you know, the topics you deal with, theater, film, music. And then also in teaching, I've always been interested in, you know, how do you include more of a popular music kind of perspective in a class on classical music, or kind of trying to bridge those things in classes for students of today. So I'd be interested in how you approach that in your research and your teaching.
Those are all very interesting questions and very philosophical ones. So it's hard to summarize a response. It's true that of the period that I'm mostly researching, and this may not be coincidental, from 1890 to 1960, I would say that classical music, as we refer to it, had much more presence in terms of a mainstream American culture. An interesting indication of this is the covers of Time magazine. If you go and you look at the covers of Time magazine, you'll see that there are many conductors, pianists, classical conductors, classical violinists, classical pianists, and composers. And not only American composers, there's that famous Time magazine of Shostakovich, and is an air warden and during World War II with his helmet. There was much more presence of classical contemporary music and contemporary American music on radio, eventually on television. Menotti, for instance, wrote Blitzstein. They both wrote radio operas. Menotti's Amahl and the Night Visitors is a landmark television opera. And The Tenderland by Copland actually began as a possible television opera. So American culture of this period was actually less divided in terms of high-low than I think what subsequently developed. And I think that if you look, that's kind of indicated by the Pulitzer Prize winners, because if you, or the gold medal winners. Well, the gold medal winners, they're so rare that people generally know who they, you know, these people are pretty prominent. Even the more recent ones like John Adams and Ned Roram. How many people, how present Yehudi Weiner is, the most recent winner in the culture, is an interesting question. That's a kind of a roundabout way of saying that the classical music of this period had sort of a popular presence. A lot of these composers also wrote film scores. And part of it is that, they themselves are drawing on folk musics, popular musics, jazz, famously Gershwin, Copland. And so they, in their classical music themselves, are integrating popular music styles or jazz styles in their music. I don't know if that answers your question, but it sort of, it kind of addresses it in a way. I don't know if you have anybody has any comments about that.
You've been writing biography for a very long time. And that's a period of time in which the field has shifted its approaches and its priorities. Why have you stuck with biography, and has your approach changed as a result of any of those shifts in the field?
Do you want to be specific and tell me what shifts you're thinking about?
Sure. I just think if we're generally describing musicological shifts away from the composer-centric story, away from life and works as a model, and maybe towards more critical studies or systematic studies, less prioritization of the individual.
Well, I guess the easiest answer is that I like writing biographies. Biographies have a long history. They go back to the Bible and the ancient Greeks. So I think that biographies, Plutarch, I think biography as a genre is something that is going to last, whatever the current trends happen to be. So that's what I like doing, and so I'm just going to keep doing what I like doing. You know, it's interesting that you ask that question, because sometimes I think myself, well, why don't you do something else? And then I look at these books and I think, how did these people write these other books? You know, biographies are, start, somebody was born, and then they die. It's like the form is kind of the only format which I was a little bit different with Gershwin. I have, because there was so much material, I had the first half life and the second half works. Usually I integrate them a little bit more. And I remember Wayne Shirley, a librarian at the Library of Congress, one of our heroes in the study of American music, said to me, "You can't have Gershwin die in the middle of your book." I said, "But the first half is life and the second half is work. He has to die in the middle of the book." So, you know, I guess that's the... But I'm sure there are trends in musicology that one, even as a biographer, will absorb. And I'm probably not the best person to notice that. I think readers will be better judges of that than I am.
So in your biographies, you've kind of stuck to like Harvard and New York, other than you like their sound, like their music. Is there like a reason why you haven't gone to like LA, to like the other notable American composers, and kind of more the like atonal, like leaning more American composers?
Well, as far as atonality goes, I probably like tonality. I suspect that I like tonality. I mean, that's like, I can only conclude that. I mean, I certainly will listen appreciatively to atonal music. But it's, as I said, if you're spending 5 years working on a composer, 5 years of atonal music might be a little bit much for me. So my own personal preference, I suppose, is a little bit more towards tonal music. As far as New York, it is interesting, and I think you mentioned this as far as Pulitzer Prize winners go, that for many, many, many years, composers lived in New York, wherever they were from. That's where publishers were there. That's where radio stations were. That's where new music organizations were performing. So as far as my composers go, I do have Walter Piston was a Bostonian, just to, you know, kind of give credit, born in Maine and lived in Boston. John Alden Carpenter, like the subtitle of my book, was a Chicagoan. And his career was actually in Chicago. And Chicago had a very interesting cultural history going back to the late 19th century with Frederick Stock at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, a major figure in American music who is very unfairly neglected in terms of his contribution to American music. Samuel Barber was from, you know, Westchester, Pennsylvania, and, you know, spent a lot of his education in Philadelphia at Curtis before, and spent much of his time with his partner Giancarlo Minotti in Italy. I don't know who I'm leaving out. Latouche was from Virginia, and Richmond, Virginia, and he was very happy to get out of Virginia. And he, as a theater composer, naturally gravitated to New York. So a lot of these composers, yes, were on the East Coast or in the Midwest, but I have a new subject now, Bloch, who's very associated with the West Coast, between his work at the San Francisco Conservatory in Berkeley and his home in Oregon. And it's interesting, Oregonians are know Bloch maybe better than anyone else currently, because he's something of a state hero because of his long residence in Oregon.
Well, Professor Pollack, we'd like to thank you for joining us today and answering questions and talking a little bit about your research and your research methodology, and also these composers that we've been spending so much time on the podcast discussing. If you'll join me in thanking him one last time for his time for us.
And thank you very much. Thank you.